You will want to open your Bible to Daniel 2 and turn in your notebook, whatever page we're on. Okay, 38. John MacArthur has called this chapter the Forgotten Dream and the Unforgettable Daniel. It is the foundation for understanding Revelation and, in fact, all of prophecy. You have to start with Daniel because he gives the most basic and simple picture of the future for us. Daniel was called a man of high esteem by the angel Gabriel. How would you like that, to be called a title like that by an angel? In this book, we will have the entire scope of prophetic history from Daniel's day all the way to Messiah's day. And the first one in chapter 2 is the most complete and yet the most simple picture that we have. They will get more complex as we go through the book. Chapter 7 next week will be more complex than this one. God was nice to start with a simple and easy prophecy first, and then we will understand more details as we go. Someone compared it to a building. You've got your studs, you're framing up. That's chapter 2. And now the rest of the Bible, we're going to be adding sheetrock and roofing and windows and brick and all of that stuff, filling in. But the basic framework will be there. The theme of Daniel is the contrast between the kingdom of man and the kingdom of God. The kingdom of man is associated with a city, Babylon. We see that all the way back from Genesis 11 all the way to Revelation 17 and 18. And it's also associated with a series of men ruling nations in rebellion against God. But the kingdom of God is associated with a city, Jerusalem, and a throne, David's throne, with a king ruling according to God's revealed written will, the scriptures. The ultimate king in man's empire will be Antichrist. The ultimate king in God's empire will be Messiah. The prophecy of chapter 2 is about God giving man dominion of the world. Man failing in his rule and God redeeming the failure by giving the rule to God-man who rules the way God intended. Adam had his chance to rule the world, remember? You're to rule the world, have dominion over the world and subdue it. Well, he failed. The Jews got a chance to be God's agent on earth and they failed. The church is supposed to be God's agent for influencing the world, not necessarily, certainly not ruling the world, but influencing the world, and we have failed. But Messiah will come back, and he'll get it right eventually. Now, at this particular time, always when nations were deported, they ceased to exist. Judah has been deported. And I know that Daniel and everybody who has been deported is worrying about what happens to the messianic promises that God gave. And so this dream given to a pagan ruler but interpreted by a Jew will reassure the Jews that God's messianic program has not stopped. It will continue. I liked Warren Wiersbe's outline for this. He always does nice outlines. God distresses a king. God disgraces the wise men. God discloses the secret. God displays his wisdom and power. God distinguishes his servants. We've got to go. I'm going to back up and get a running start at this chapter. We're going all the way back to David. David wanted to build a house for God, and God said, no, you can't do it, but I will build a house for you. And he made a promise to David, I will give you an eternal house or dynasty. Someone from David's line will have the right to rule forever. He also promised an eternal kingdom to David. There will be people to rule. And he promised a throne or the right to rule to David. So it's a throne, a dynasty, and a kingdom that were promised to David. And all of a sudden, all of that has collapsed. There's no king on the throne in Jerusalem. Because the king was carried off in the first, I think the first deportation, no, I guess it was the last deportation where their king was taken off. After David came Solomon, and then the kingdom split. because Solomon's son was not a wise ruler. There was kind of a military coup, and the captain of the army took about 10 tribes, the northern 10 tribes, and formed the nation of Israel with its capital at Samaria. And then two tribes stayed loyal to the Davidic dynasty, and that would be Judah and Benjamin, and they named their nation Judah. Well, there was no godly king ever in Israel because they all were worshiping the golden calves that Jeroboam had set up. There were a few godly kings in Judah. God kept warning them, if you don't obey me, you're going to be disciplined. And eventually Assyria came down and deported all the people in Israel. So the northern 10 tribes were carried off into the Assyrian Empire and scattered all over the Assyrian Empire. And then they brought in other people, and they intermarried with some of the few Jews that were left and became the Samaritans. That's why the Jews hated them so much, because they were interbreeding with other nations. So that's the northern kingdom. In 722, it's been disciplined. Okay, Judah is still in existence. And God keeps warning them, look what I did to your sister. You better straighten up. But they don't. 150 years go by, and Babylon, which has now conquered Assyria, is the ruling kingdom. And it comes in and begins to deport the people from Judah. Nebuchadnezzar was the crown prince. And he was down in Egypt fighting for his kingdom, for his father, trying to conquer Egypt and Syria for Babylon. And he got word that his father had died. So he headed back across the desert just as fast as he could to get back to his throne so he could become king before somebody else took it. And then as he went, in 606, he took a group of Judean noblemen's sons with him. They were taken more as hostages, but they were also taken to train in the government of Babylon so that they could go out and do the government's work. So they were not prisoners of war so much as they were hostages, because your parents back home are going to behave if you're in Babylon. But they were also being trained for government service. Daniel and his three friends were a part of this particular group. And as our story begins, in chapter 2, Daniel and his three friends are apparently still in training. They had a three-year training for them. And this is the second year of Nebuchadnezzar on his throne. So apparently they're still in training. So our chapters 2 is starting with remember Nebuchadnezzar is still a young man at this time, and he's kind of insecure, because everybody was insecure back then. There were assassinations and coups all the time. Shakespeare said, uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. Well, Nebuchadnezzar was uneasy that night. He had a dream, and in his culture, dreams meant that the gods were speaking to you. And if you didn't remember the dream, it meant that the gods were angry with you. So he's in a bit of a pickle here. He's not sure exactly what's going on. He calls in his wise men, and those were the astrologers and the people who did all sorts of study, but they were also including a group of people called the Chaldeans, and they were, I think you could say, the leading tribe of Babylonia. They were, in fact, Nebuchadnezzar himself was a Chaldean. They were considered very skillful, not necessarily astrologers. But they were learned men and wise men, and they could interpret political affairs. You might consider them something like our cabinets. But Nebuchadnezzar is unwilling or unable, and it's not real sure what is going on. But he will not tell the wise men the dream. And they, of course, panic, because if they can't do what he wants, off goes their head. Dreams were so important that we have actually, the archaeologists have found official state dream interpretation manuals. Lots of material on how to interpret a dream, but you had to know the details of the dream. And they don't know the dream, the details. They don't know the dream. They don't know the details. And so they say, no man on earth. And they're right. No man on earth can interpret dreams. See, what you're asking of his king is a little bit irrational. So he's kind of mad, and he decides that they will all be executed, and he sends out an order for them to be executed. But apparently Daniel and his friends were not in the group that came before the king, and he hears what's happening, and he asks, why are we all supposed to be executed? Since he's in training, he's going to be executed. And when he hears the reason why, he asks for some time, something that was not granted to the other wise men. He asks for some time, and then he says that he can interpret the dream. He tells the Arioch, the king's bodyguard, that there is a God in heaven who can interpret the dream. Daniel didn't know the dream. He didn't know the answer to the dream, but he knew the God who did. He knew the God who had sent it. And so he was trusting that God would supply the answer to the dream. God revealed the mystery to all four of them. If you notice down in one of the verses, it says that God has told us. So all four of them knew the dream and the interpretation of them. And the first thing Daniel did was praise God for doing that. He praised God for his wisdom. That's what he is in himself. He knows how to control the world. He also praised God for his power, what he is in relation to mankind. He has the ability to control the world. And he praised God for the revelation, what he is in relation to this specific situation. He's going to reveal the dream. His prayer of praise shows that he was deeply entrenched in Scripture. There are at least 17 references to Scriptures in his prayer of praise. Now, he acknowledges that it is God who controls the succession of events and eras and who sets up and takes down kings and gives wisdom to men. And notice his humility. He recognizes that he can do nothing apart from God. And I contrast that with Arioch, who went in and said, I have found. That's kind of funny, isn't it? Because it was Daniel who had approached Arioch, but he says, I have found. But to be fair, Arioch is risking his life by not executing this wise man right away. So he's staking everything on Daniel and Daniel's trust in God. So he is trusting God. He's trusting Daniel, who trusts in God. I think it was, I did ask you, would he have been able to take a stand like this if it had not been for what happened in chapter 1? Would he have been able to trust God like that? It was his viewpoint on life and his trust in God and his obedience to God's laws and the fact that he had already made up his mind that he would not be defiled by anything in Babylon that gave him the courage to do this. And I also wanted to mention that they called Daniel Belteshazzar. Did you notice that? That's his Babylonian name. Daniel is his Hebrew name. Anytime you have El in a name, it represents Elohim or God. So Daniel means God is my judge. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are always called by their Babylonian names. Their Jewish names were Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, I think. They all had God in them. Yah is like in Hananiah, the I on the end is from Yah or Yahweh. So they changed their names. And when you change a person's name, you kind of change, hoping to at least change their worldview, their view of themselves, making them a part of your culture. And the Baal in there is one of the gods that the Babylonians worship. So instead of letting Daniel carry his name that represents Elohim, the god of Judah, they gave him a name that represented a god of Babylon. I watched the creation debate between Ken Ham and Bill Nye, the science guy, and at one point congregation or the audience was allowed to ask questions, and Bill Nye was asked, where did the material come from for the Big Bang? And where did human consciousness come from? And he said, well, it's just a mystery. That's one of the wonderful mysteries of the universe. And Ken Nye said he was thinking, how am I going to rebut this answer? And he just had a sudden inspiration. He was praying while he was talking, and he just picked up his Bible, and he said, Bill, there is a Bible, or there is a book. Bill, there is a book that tells and reveals those mysteries. And I think the same thing is true here when Daniel said, "There is a God." That phrase just kind of made me think of Bill saying, "There is Ken saying, there is a book. There is a God in heaven who can reveal this." He reminds Nebuchadnezzar that it is God who removes kings and sets up kings. You are here because God had put you here. Now, Nebuchadnezzar his armies had recently defeated Egypt and Syria. So there's nothing left now to conquer. And there's no power to challenge him, but Daniel tells him, all your victories are from the God of heaven. It's interesting that God revealed to a pagan king what is going to happen during the times of the Gentiles. The times of the Gentiles began when Jerusalem fell and extend to when Messiah sets up his kingdom. So we are in the times of the Gentiles now. You have that in your glossary if you want to go back and look at it again. This is reassurance, as I said before, for Judah that there's going to be a kingdom in the end that would be ruled by God. But this particular prophecy lays out a succession of four kingdoms that will be ruling over Israel, climaxed by a fifth kingdom, which would destroy the others. And in this vision of this image, it gives man's perspective on man's rule of the world. It's a glorious image, mighty and awesome. We will see later in Daniel God's perspective on man's ruling the earth, and God pictures them as beasts rather than a glorious man. All history is connected with Israel. The Bible is Jerusalem-centric. It is not a Western book, it is an Eastern book, and it is written about the particular area of the Bible. I want you to turn now to your maps. I forgot to tell you last week, they're there for you to look at. So turn back to page 14. The first map you have given is that of the Assyrian Empire. That's before our study takes up. It came before Babylon, which is where we're going to start. But I wanted you to see the size of it. This was the nation that defeated and deported the northern kingdom, the Assyrian Empire. Nineveh was its capital. And you can understand now why Jonah did not want to go to Nineveh and preach, because he didn't want the nation's enemies to have any mercy from God. But God used Jonah's preaching to bring about a revival, which in turn saved Israel for another 100 years or so from deportation. So this is the Assyrian Empire. Now where our story takes up is with the Babylonian Empire. And you can see it didn't quite cover everything. Babylonia is the name of the nation or the empire, and Babylon is the name of the city. And as we mentioned last week, it's just a few miles down the river from Baghdad. This is what they had covered. They had gone a little bit into Turkey today, which is Cilicia on the map. They began in 606 and... they began in 626, the nation was established. I've tried to give you the same information in your written material and in a chart and in a picture so you can kind of put it all together. So we've added a chart this week. You might get that out. Now you've seen where that particular Babylonian Empire is. Now look at page 36. Keep your finger where we are and go back to 36. This is a chart that I ask you to study. The kingdoms of this world. This will cover the kingdoms, the four successive kingdoms plus the fifth one. Today we're just going to be interested in the first two columns on the top chart, the kingdoms of this world. So Nebuchadnezzar's image starts with a head of gold, and he tells Nebuchadnezzar that this represents him or the nation, the kingdom of Babylon. That is the only empire that will be named in chapter 2 of Daniel. The others, Daniel will have to wait 50 years before he finds out what the other portions of the statue represent. So you might look at your chart, and here's the head of gold representing the Babylonian Empire. So God is revealing to Nebuchadnezzar, you're going to be the head of gold, and your empire will rule. And it's interesting to me that Babylonia, ruled for about 70 years. And that was the period of time that the Jews were in captivity. So shortly after Babylon became an empire, they captured the Jews and took them over to Babylon. And then they endured for 70 years. And when it got about time for Judah to go back, then there became another kingdom in place, and that was Medo-Persia. And they were the ones who allowed them to go back to their land. There were three deportations of Jews. The first ones were from the rich and the noblemen and the government kids. That was in about 606. Is it 597 for the second one? And then the last one is in 586 when the temple was destroyed and Jerusalem was destroyed completely. And so we generally count the times of the Gentiles from 586 when the temple was destroyed. Now, he has a second portion of the image, the chest and the arms of silver. That will be Medo-Persia.
Was the time of the Gentiles then, or was it after Christ was crucified?
No, it began when there was no longer a king ruling on the throne of Israel, Judah. The times of the Gentiles began when the nation of Judah was destroyed. Because now Gentiles are ruling over Israel. And it just continued right on to the end of the tribulation. The chest and arms of silver represent the Medo-Persian Empire. We'll find that out later. Then the belly and the thighs of brass represent the Empire of Greece. And the fourth beast, with the legs of iron, feet of iron, and clay, represent a fourth kingdom that is never named in the Bible. I did not realize that until this study. Now, we know from history that Rome followed Greece in its control over Judah. But never does God call this fourth kingdom Rome. And that may be significant. Now, when we get down to the 10 toes, note that there is a gap here before we get to the toes. That is the gap of the church age. You see the cross here? The gap of the church age. And we get down to then the 10 toes. That's going to represent Antichrist's kingdom. And then we have the stone that comes and knocks the whole bit down. And that represents Christ and his kingdom. Now, how are we doing with understanding that? Pretty simple. Okay? Now, I just want to talk a little bit more about this, the statue part and its place in God's design. The fact that it is a man shows that it is man's attempt to control the world apart from God. The head indicates intelligence and unity. Babylon was responsible for the idea of one world government, and that goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 11 when Nimrod, who was of the line of Cush from Noah, decided to build a tower unto heaven and make a name for themselves. Instead of scattering out, he wanted to unite the people together. So the idea of a one-world government and a one-world religion all goes back to that Tower of Babel, because apparently it was a means of approaching the gods of heaven. Not God, but the gods. So it was intended to be a worship thing as well as a political thing. So the idea of world government And world religion goes all the way back to the Tower of Babel, which is where Babylon comes from. So Babylon is responsible for this particular idea. And in the end time, Babylon will be the head of a one world government. The city of Babylon will be. It's hard to believe right now. It's just a dusty little place and not even really inhabited. It's kind of a fine arts place right now. Saddam was able to restore, it's just used as theater and things like that. But one day, it will be the capital of the one world empire. Now, God used Babylon to cure Israel, or Judah, actually, from idolatry. In the last days before Ezekiel was deported, and he was deported in the second deportation, he saw idols in the temple, people worshiping idols in the temple, a dreadful, horrible thing. But their captivity cured them of that. They learned that that was something that God would not put up with. And it's beginning to prepare the world for the idea of unity under the Roman Empire and then under Christ. The Medo-Persian Empire, talk a little bit about that. The Medes and the Persians were related tribes up in this particular area. And you may want to go back to your maps and let's look at the Medo-Persian Empire and see on page 15. And note how much larger it is than the Babylonian Empire. As we go down the statue, it will decrease in value. The metals used will decrease in value. And the kings represented, or the empires represented, decrease in power as they go down. Nebuchadnezzar was an absolute ruler. But the kings of Medo-Persia had to obey the laws. Remember when they tried to throw Daniel in the lion's den? And the king had to obey that law because he had made it. They couldn't. The laws of the Medes and Persians could not be changed. Nebuchadnezzar could do as he pleased. The leaders of Medo-Persia could not. The leaders of Greece did not have quite that much power. And when you get down to Rome, you're into a republic, really, rather than a monarchy or a dictatorship. But notice how much more material land that the Medo-Persia Empire covered. The Medes and the Persians were tribes that were back over toward the east from Babylon. And they began to grow strong under Cyrus the Great's father. And then in about 550, they managed to conquer Babylon and became the rulers of this particular area. They went much further east and much further west. Note that they've gone down to Egypt and all along the edge of the Mediterranean. Up there where it says Phrygia, that's Turkey today. So that's all Asia Minor. They've captured that, and they're going on toward Athens and Greece. That little peninsula coming down on the top left is Greece. So that's the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, they were used by God to return the Jews back to their land. Remember when we got Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther, it was the Persian king that allowed them to go back to their land. They actually helped rebuild the temple, and they developed an efficient communication system. Remember when we studied them, we studied the fact that the idea of the Pony Express comes from the Persians. They set up a real fast system where they could get mail all over the empire. It's a huge empire, and you didn't have telegraph back then, so you had to have pony riders, and they just set up this efficient communication system, which would become very useful when it comes to spreading the gospel of Christ. The belly and thighs representing Greece. Alexander the Great was the father of Philip of Macedon. At this particular time, just before Greece becomes an empire, it's a bunch of warring city-states, basically. And Philip of Macedon consolidated them into an empire, a bunch of people who were all united. And when he died, Alexander took over and started conquering. Well, Alexander was faced with an army that couldn't communicate. This city-state had its own language, and this city-state had its own language, and really it was a different forms of Greece, of Greek. So what he did, and by the way, Alexander was educated by Aristotle. I always think that's interesting. What he did was have Aristotle make up a common Greek language so that they could all understand. So we have what they call the Koine Greek, which is the common Greek. So what he did was provide a language for the gospel to be written and spread in. So you can see as God moves through history, he is preparing the world for the Messiah's advent. And then the last one were the legs of iron. That's the Roman Empire. When they came in, they built roads. I've walked on a Roman road in England. It's still there after all these hundreds of years. They built a very efficient system of roads and laws that would help contribute to the spread of the gospel when Christ finally came. So God uses all these empires. They think they're ruling the world for themselves, but God is using them for himself to set up the world for Jesus. Now, in verse 38 of chapter 2, I think this was a question. I'll back up to 37. Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar, "You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold." All right, Nebuchadnezzar is told that anywhere men and animals live, you're in charge of it. But you saw how small the Babylonian Empire was. So how do you correlate the apparent discrepancy? He was given the right to rule the world, but he didn't rule it all. The only way I can answer that is that they were given the right but did not or were not able to exercise it. Or secondly, and I think this is probably the right one, God has given them to rule over the part that is concerning Israel. The part of the earth that impacts Israel is being controlled by these Gentile nations. We learn from this that man's rule will be suddenly, violently destroyed. Remember the stone that came and crushed? That represents the kingdom that grew and becomes the messianic kingdom. Does it gradually chip away at man's empire through the years? It comes suddenly and it hits the bottom of the statue and the whole statue is destroyed and carried away by the wind. So it's a sudden thing. It's not the fact that the church is going to eventually bring in the rule of Christ by chipping away at the rule of man. It's the fact that a stone cut without hands is going to come and knock down all the kingdoms of the world. And then we see that God's kingdom grows and takes over the world only after the elimination of man's kingdoms. He knocks them all down and then God comes in and sets up his kingdom. Note, too, that man had nothing to do with establishing God's kingdom. It was a stone cut without hands. No man's hands touched the stone. Rome was not destroyed when Christ came. Rome continued to exist. So Christ did not set up his kingdom then. The church is not the kingdom. The kingdom is yet to come, the messianic kingdom. I want to keep emphasizing that. We are not the kingdom. We do not inherit the promises made. The kingdom promise is made to Judah. Now, let me see. What do you think is meant by the stone that is cut out of the mountain without hands? That was one of the questions I asked you on page 39, question 11. What does a stone cut without hands represent?
Jesus.
All right, it represents Jesus. It represents the fact that he's not human. He's not tainted by anything that is human. It's made by God's hands. Remember, Christ said, "My kingdom is not of this world. It comes from somewhere else." The last kingdom doesn't become Christ's kingdom. You remember, it was given to him by the Father. There was a parable about a nobleman who went into a far country to receive a kingdom. That's speaking of Christ who went into the far country, heaven, to receive his kingdom. Now, let's look at our notes on page 40. Yes.
On number 12, you know, you said the church is not the kingdom, but don't you think that when Christ reigns in the heart of a believer, you're part of the kingdom? Maybe we're part of the kingdom to come, but...
I think that we could be described as being a part of a spiritual kingdom right now, but not a literal physical kingdom. Is the church a part? I need to repeat the question. If Christ is ruling in our hearts, aren't we part of the kingdom? Yes, we are a part of a spiritual kingdom, but not the messianic kingdom yet. We will be a part of the messianic kingdom, but not yet. I want to distinguish between a spiritual kingdom and a literal kingdom, because much of the church today believes that it's just a spiritual kingdom and that there will be no literal reign of Jesus on earth at the end of time. So that's why I keep harping on this. On your notes, I pointed out that only the first kingdom is actually identified to Daniel. It will be 50 years before he finds out the others. At this time, Persia was simply a Babylonian satrapy, which might be, you could call it like a state or a county. Greece was simply a lot of warring tribes, and Rome was only a small village. And three, the succession of metals grows less valuable but stronger. Iron is stronger than gold, isn't it? I have a ring that I've shaped to fit my finger, and I can only, it's apparently a very nice gold, and it only fits my finger one way because gold is so soft and malleable. Iron, you can't change without fire. Each successive king had less absolute power, but each kingdom lasted longer than the preceding one. So that's interesting. Now, the kingdoms prior to the final kingdom of God are Gentile kingdoms ruling during a period of history when the throne of David, associated with Israel and Jerusalem, remains unoccupied. So that's basically another definition of the times of the Gentile. All four kingdoms continue to exist in the cultural and religious and governmental aspects so that when the final one is crushed, all are crushed. Remember, we have Roman roads, we have Roman laws, we have a Persian government set up somehow or another. All the kingdoms continue to kind of absorb the culture of the other kingdoms. So when you destroy the final kingdom, which will be Antichrist's kingdom, you will destroy all of them. Point seven, the dream reveals that the fourth kingdom has three phases: iron alone, feet of iron mixed with clay, and toes of iron mixed with clay. So there's three forms to the final kingdom. The toes would correspond to a 10-nation confederation, which we're going to talk about next week, which will occupy the territory formerly controlled by the fourth kingdom. Also, the two legs may represent divisions within that fourth kingdom. The fourth kingdom was Rome, but it was so large that it was difficult to control it. And we might look back at our map now. Look at Greece. We haven't looked at how far Greece went. When you look at a map like this, try to find one feature. This is on page 15. Try to find one feature that will help you orient yourself. I use, in these maps, I use the Sinai Peninsula. Can you see that down there just to the east of Egypt, that little V-shaped peninsula? I look for that in every map so that I can orient myself. So you can see that Greece went even further east and much further west than the Medo-Persian Empire did. And then if you turn over to page 16, you see the Roman Empire at its height. And it really covered a lot of area, a lot more area westward, but not eastward. It did not go as far as the others did toward the east. And it also went in Africa, all across northern Africa. So basically, it's all this area around the Mediterranean Sea. Because it was such a large empire, it was hard to hold together. And eventually, it split into two sections, one in the west, and the capital was in Rome, and another in the east, and the capital was in Turkey. And the one in the west was eventually, it eventually fell apart and was absorbed by the Roman Catholic Church. It kind of changed from being a political thing to a religious thing. And the Roman Catholic Church ruled the West for about 1,000 years. So much so that I can remember one of the Henrys, one of the kings of England, had to crawl on his knees in the snow, or kneel on his knees in the snow, for 3 days outside the Pope's palace, begging the Pope not to excommunicate England, because if the Pope excommunicated England, everybody in England would go to hell. So he controlled even the kings. The Pope had enormous power during this particular time, and he controlled even the kings of the nations. And basically then, the Roman Catholic Church was the power in the West. But the power in the East continued in a Roman emperor called Constantine. He was about in the 300s of the Roman Empire. And I think the Roman Empire kind of fell apart in about the 5th Empire or the 400s. It just kind of disintegrated into different nations like France and Spain and Germany, etc. But they were able to keep the eastern portion held together. And this was because they were changing religions, kind of. Constantinople moved to Byzantium, which was the capital of Turkey about that time, and changed its name to Constantinople. And then the Muslims then began to grow in about the 600s. Remember, Muhammad was born in 632, maybe. I forget all this stuff. But the Muslims began to grow in power, and eventually they conquered what was left of the Roman Empire in the east, and it became the Ottoman Empire, which was Muslim. And it ruled that part of the world for a long time, and they changed the name of the capital city to Istanbul, which it is today. If you look down, I've given you a map of the Ottoman Empire. It did not stretch all over the Roman Empire. It did not go as far as the western portion controlled by the Pope, but it did stretch all the way down the Arabian Peninsula, down there past Arabia and all those little emirates down there, and as far as Persia. And the Ottoman Empire lasted from the 600s to 1914, or basically 1923, when after the First World War, it was divided up. It was conquered, and it was divided up among nations like Syria and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, etc. The people who had helped the Allies got to be monarchs in all these little nations. So you've got the whole flow of history in this particular statue. Okay, now let's go back and let me see. So the two legs may represent the two portions of the Roman Empire, okay? Eventually, this fourth kingdom's going to fall apart, and that will give rise to the Antichrist. History reveals that there were, I'm reading number 10, that there were and are many other kingdoms and nations in the world during the times of the Gentiles, yet they do not represent kingdoms of significance to Israel, and so they are omitted from God in his prophecies. The Mayans and the Aztecs were there, the Indians, the Chinese, all of these people were there, but God doesn't focus on them. He's only focusing on the nations that have an impact on Israel and Judah.
So where do we
stand now?
We're in the church age gap. See that gap of time there? That's where we are. You might put us right there if you want to. We have yet to come to the feet and the toes, which will represent Antichrist's kingdom on the statue. Where do we stand now was the question. I've got to remember to repeat the question.
At the end of the gap of time?
At the end of the gap of time. Wouldn't that be nice? I hope we are. It looks like we're getting closer, doesn't it? Now, did you have any questions about the questions I gave you? Anything that you did not understand or that you need to clarify? I basically gave you the questions so that you would have something to study and have a foundation for this study. So nobody has any problem with the questions. All right, now I want to go on. Okay.
Ask question number four. No. No. That's okay. I can't find it.
Can't find the question?
No, no, I can't.
Okay. I tried to make the questions easy. Tried not to make them really difficult for you.
God of heaven was referred to so many times in this chapter.
Okay, that's a good point. The God of heaven. That's a term that reminds everybody that God is ruling from heaven. And it's a term that is generally used among Gentiles, particularly during the Gentile time books, like Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther and Daniel and Ezekiel. The God of heaven is a term that is used to indicate God's superiority over things. Oh, okay.
So that was a contrast. He was telling that to Nebuchadnezzar. This is the God of heaven.
Very good. Helen says that she read somewhere that the Babylonians believed their gods came from the earth. So that's a real contrast then when Daniel keeps pointing out the God of heaven. Good comment.
In so many other Oriental countries, they worship many gods like that before. And the missionaries say that they have the hardest time. They will accept our God and put it on the list of their gods, but they must be sure that they worship the one God before they are converted.
Yes, that is a problem when you start ministering in polytheistic nations, because they are quite willing to add Jesus to their pantheon. Just got another nice God, you know. So it's hard for them to understand that he is the only God. And it's hard for Muslims to understand the Trinity, because they are a monotheistic religion. So it's hard.
Question number 12.
Okay.
In that it would be a spiritual kingdom, everything would be born again. It will be. So that means that everything of the earth will be destroyed.
Yes. What do you think this kingdom will be? That's referring to the stone that comes back. It will be the messianic kingdom.
And it talks about a righteous kingdom.
Yes.
So it's made up. Right now we're spiritual, but we're not a part of the righteous kingdom.
Well, we're certainly not righteous, except that we have the imputed righteousness of Christ.
But that's what I'm asking.
Okay. How will it be a righteous kingdom?
Yes, when everything else is destroyed, because we...
Okay, all the kingdoms of mankind are going to be destroyed. And Christ will set up his kingdom. And he will rule with a rod of righteousness. And that's how the kingdom will be a righteous kingdom. Whenever any... there will still be human beings with... sin natures in the messianic kingdom. This is the 1,000-year reign of Christ. But when they sin, they will be punished. And it'll be so nice to see a criminal get what's coming to him instead of what we have nowadays, when they do not get justice for what they have done. But justice and righteousness will be a prevailing feature of the messianic kingdom. Okay.
Miss Sanders, I don't quite understand the church gap. Would you mind?
The church age gap. Okay. In the Old Testament, God had promised a messianic kingdom to the Jews. When Christ came and offered that kingdom to the Jews, remember he said, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." They rejected the king and they killed him. And the clock for that messianic kingdom stopped, so to speak. God quit dealing with the Jews as a nation and started dealing with them as individuals. Any Jew who trusts Christ today is a member of the church and is not a member of Israel, so to speak, nationally. And this church age gap is that time when Christ, when God quit dealing with Israel as a nation, and it stretches all the way until Christ comes back and sets up his kingdom. Stretches all the way to the first part of the tribulation, when the church is taken out in the rapture, the church disappears from the earth, and God once again goes back to dealing with the Jews as a nation. Was that clear enough? You got the church age gap. Okay, that's where we are today. The one thing I wanted to talk to you about, when turn to page 26 now. Traditionally, Christians have understood that the final empire of Antichrist to be Western, specifically Rome. We've called it Rome II. You know, we've talked about Rome I and Rome II, that when the Antichrist comes, he's going to be a Western leader and will have a Western confederacy of nations, and that he will be a Western Antichrist, so to speak. Question? Okay. This is number two. However, the nations that the Bible identifies as comprising Antichrist empire are today all Muslim, many of whom are presently experiencing a resurgence of Islamic fundamentalism. That is a understatement. That so-called Arab Spring, when everybody thought, oh, they're going to adopt democracy. No, they didn't. They went into a more vicious form of Islam. In number four, it appears that the feet are the fourth and fifth empires are closely related, and there's a mistake, not relation, but related, and yet still separate, so that they could be understood as phase one and phase two of the fourth empire. You understand that we've always talked of Rome I and Rome II, a revived Roman Empire. Now, Joel Richardson sees the fourth empire as being the Islamic caliphate and the feet of mixed iron and clay as the restored Islamic caliphate rather than Rome 1 and 2. I think that I would like to think of the fourth empire as being Rome, and then revived Rome as being the Islamic caliphate rather than Rome. In other words, we've always thought, oh, the European common market or the Club of Rome or all of these people are going to head up a Western empire, and Antichrist will come from Rome. That's because we're Western and we think about ourselves as being the center of the world. But all of these nations that are named in prophecy as making up the final confederation that fights against Christ are Muslim, Islamic nations that surround Israel. So I would like to suggest, and this is just a suggestion, that this fourth empire that comes is Rome I. It had to be. It followed Greece. But I'm suggesting that the fifth empire that comes in there in the feet form will be the Islamic caliphate. Now, that was a strange thing to me when I began to study this, because we had never heard of ISIS. But now we have. And ISIS is the Islamic State of Israel, Iraq and Syria. And they have set up a caliphate, and they have named a caliph or a leader. So they are already beginning to strive towards setting up a rule. Their intention is to take back everything that belonged to the Ottoman Empire and make it Muslim and set up a capital in Turkey, the capital of the Islamic State. Syria. They started out as ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which is that L-E-V-A-N-T, which is that little narrow strip of land that Syria is on and Lebanon. But then they've changed it to ISIS, calling it Syria. And now they just want to be called the Islamic State. That's what they want to be called. So they are setting up a final kingdom, or attempting to set up a final kingdom that will rule that part of the world, and it will be Muslim. So I'm going to suggest that there's a fifth empire in here that's not the Messianic kingdom, but is an Islamic kingdom. And then there's a sixth empire, which is the Messianic kingdom. I know that's new, and it is a theory only. We won't know until it happens. If the Lord tarries for another 1,000 years, goodness me, America could be gone, all these nations could be gone, Islam could be gone. But right now, if we want to interpret it, if it might happen right now, it would probably be an Islamic state from which the Antichrist will come. Okay?
It's interesting how our world is changing so quickly. Right now, Scotland is voting to separate from the United Kingdom, and that would be the breakdown of the England is removed.
Yeah, that is rather strange that all of a sudden Scotland wants to break down. I will point out, too, that even if it is an Islamic state of Antichrist, it still comes out of what was the Roman Empire. Remember, Turkey was a part of the Roman Empire. So it still grows out of that. And we'll see that later on when we see other details of these visions. Point 8, many of the Jewish rabbis have long understood the final ten-horn kingdom to be an Arab or Middle Eastern kingdom or descendants of Esau. So the Jews have all along seen this as not a Western kingdom like Rome, but a Middle Eastern kingdom. Ten horn or ten toes, the ten horns compared to the ten toes. Nowhere in the Bible does the Bible name that fourth empire as being Rome. Not anywhere. We assume that it was Rome, and we have for hundreds of years assumed that it was Rome because Rome followed Greece and conquered the area of Judah. Okay, good. That's a good reason to assume so. A second reason we have assumed that is that in Daniel chapter 9, he talks about the prince to come, that's the Antichrist, whose people will destroy the sanctuary. Well, the Roman army destroyed the sanctuary. So we think, okay, Antichrist will be Roman. But an interesting thing about that is that the Roman legions were not sufficient to hold the empire together, and so they hired mercenaries. And the people who actually destroyed the temple in Judah in 70 AD were Syrians. They had been hired from Syria, and they were Muslims. Not Muslims, but they were not Jews and not Westerners, not Romans. They were Syrians, and they hated the Jews. Rome, from the emperor down to Titus, the conqueror, had been telling them not to destroy the temple. Rome did not come along and just destroy everything. Remind me to come back to that idea in a minute. Rome didn't come down and destroy everything. They tried to keep as much of let their people keep as much of their culture and their language and their laws as possible. So Rome had said, don't tear down that temple. Well, these Syrian soldiers hated the Jews, and they were the ones who set fire to the temple and tore it down. What happened? The gold in the temple melted and went into the cracks of the temple stone between the stones. And then to get to the gold, they tore the stones apart. So no stone was left standing when they destroyed the temple. So you could say that Syria, which is now Muslim, was responsible for destroying the sanctuary. So they could be the people who will come and destroy the sanctuary. So we've knocked down two good reasons why Rome is not going to furnish us the final Antichrist. As I say, this is just simply a theory right now. In my defense, I will say that John MacArthur is preaching it, and that gives it credence in my mind. Yeah. Okay, another preacher who's preaching that, Baxter is his name?
Irwin Baxter.
Irwin?
He's out of Plano.
Okay, another one, Irwin Baxter out of Plano, who's preaching this. So that may change as time goes by. We may begin to see that that's what the Bible was predicting.
Another thing that we might think about this church, age of the Gentile, is the Great Commission being fulfilled as we go out and evangelize the world. Is that not in this church age?
Yes, that's what we're supposed to be doing during the church age.
When you think about the church age, from Christ's ascension from the earth, the Spirit being given, the evangelism going out from Jerusalem, all over the world,
uh-huh,
from Judea, you know, into all the world.
Okay.
So that's what, in my mind, when we think about this church age, that's what I think of.
That's the church age is the time when the church is to be evangelizing the world, ministering to the world. We're going to be gone at the end of the church age. And it started with the descent of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. Okay, I wanted to run back now. I said that we talked about Rome... not destroying the culture and the religion, but this, we will find out later, this fifth kingdom destroys and crushes everything that went before it, just like the Muslims do. When the Muslims conquer a place, they destroy. They will not allow any other religious viewpoint, any freedom of religion whatsoever. I was just reading this morning from Brian Fisher. I don't know if any of you are familiar with his articles. He said that the Muslims in America are beginning to put pressure on stores and restaurants to quit carrying pork. And he had tweeted over the weekend, and I don't do tweets, so I don't know, but he had just tweeted that bacon proves that America is a Christian nation. Because we are free to buy bacon here. You can't get a BLT in Jerusalem, and neither can you get one in any Muslim country. And the Muslims, as they gain in power here in America, are beginning to pressure restaurants and stores to keep, the Jews would call it keep kosher, the Muslims call it keep halal, H-A-L-A-L, to get rid of any pork products. And there is actually a store in a restaurant, I believe, in Vermont, who has taken down his sign advertising. No, I guess he's a store because he sells this Vermont, special Vermont bacon. He actually took the sign down advertising that he sells bacon because he was afraid that his store would experience some vandalism or something. So they are beginning to have an effect already in influencing our culture. All right. Yes, on our universities today, Christians are not allowed to have clubs, but Muslims can, and the universities have to cater to the needs of Muslim students, all in the name of freedom of religion. One of the things that Brian Fisher points out is that the founders had no idea of any other religion than Christianity when they wrote the Constitution. It was to be freedom of religion for Christians. Now, as long as the Jews and the Mohammedans came and worshipped their own way, there was no big deal. But the First Amendment clause has in mind establishing a Christian denomination as a state nation, as a state religion. And that's all it has in mind. It does not mean that there's no supposed to be separation between government and religion. I think that's about all I had today. Do you have questions or any other comments? It's unclean. Why don't the Muslims approve of pork? They follow the Jewish laws of pork being unclean. They do accept part of the Old Testament, and they've rewritten it, of course, to suit them, but pork is to them unclean. Anything else?
Prayer requests.
And your prayer request to Betsy. We have a great group. I appreciate you all coming.